There's no way we could give you everything we'd like to give you on our five-day conference, but so we're going to just hit a couple things here. Number two, where it says program around your purpose, I wanted to give you these fill-ins. At Saddleback, we have a major program for each group. If you'll write these in, for the community, we have bridge events. Bridge events. Those are events like Easter, Christmas Eve, a harvest party we have during Halloween, some things we do in the summer that are big events for the entire community. This Easter, I did 8 Easter services. We started Saturday afternoon at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, did 4 on Saturday, 4 on Sunday, had a total attendance of over 26,000 people for Easter, and we had over 1,000 professions of faith on Easter Sunday. Now the reason that happened, that's the second Easter in a row we've had over 1,000 people saved on Easter. And the reason why is because over 17 years we've built it into a community event. We had over 4,000 people who attended our church for the very first time on Easter. This may as well have been a Billy Graham crusade. Because we have trained our folks just by using little cards of inviting people to come where they give public invitations to their friends. And we do these bridge events a couple times a year. At Christmas, we'll do 8 or 9 Christmas Eve services. We'll start at like noon and go to 9 or 10 o'clock at night and have well over 25,000 people for a service. Well, how do we do that? Well, each year you just build on it. For the crowd, we have our seeker services. That's our weekend service. We're going to spend a whole session, or at least part of a session, on developing a seeker service. For the congregation, our key program is the small groups. Small groups. We tell people, you're not going to really feel a part of the church until you get in the small group. We have not found small groups to be effective for evangelism in our area. We've found that seekers are more likely to come to a large group meeting and then nurture in a small group meeting. Now, that may be different in your area, but that's just how it works for us. For the committed, we have midweek services. It's our midweek believer service, which is different from our seeker service we do on the weekends. The midweek service is designed for teaching people in-depth Bible and long, in-depth worship also. And for the core, we have what we call SALT, S-A-L-T. It stands for Saddleback Advanced Leadership Training. I know a number of people have SALT. They call it Servant and Leader Training. It's a once-a-month rally where the people who are in the core get together for 2 hours on a Sunday night, and we give them training, we give them inspiration, we commission new lay leaders. It's a monthly, ongoing, it's my chance to be with the core. If I'm sick, I will give up preaching to the 13,000 on Sunday morning in order to have strength to speak to the core at the SALT meeting. It is the most important meeting of the month. It's when I get together with all the core and we do training and leadership. Those training tapes those training messages are on tape. They're called Leadership Lifters. And you can get them either on the internet or you can order them through the Encouraging Word. And we'll give you that a little bit later. On page 15, educate your people on purpose. I would suggest that you need to set up a series of classes that take people from membership to maturity to ministry to mission. We do it using a baseball diamond. And in the baseball diamond, getting to first base means you've taken class 101, which is a membership class. Each of these classes, the first base, second base, third base, home base class, are 4 hours long. They're taught one 4-hour segment, and you finish the class. They're taught monthly, all at the same time, on the second Sunday afternoon of the month. We've tried many different times. It doesn't matter when you teach them. Once you've taken class 101 and joined the church and signed the membership covenant, you can go on the second base, take class 201, a class on how to grow spiritually, and it's the basic habits for growth. You sign a covenant there, you're eligible then to go on to third base, discovering my ministry, class 301, and we'll explain these a little bit more in detail in the future. And then when you move on around to home plate, discovering my life mission and evangelism training. When you've taken all 4 classes, you finish 16 hours of training, and you get a little pen, a bronze pen, says, I've committed these 4 things. We've got this for these people. Now, the point here is that you don't get credit for people left on base. Most churches do a pretty good job of getting people to first base. They get them saved, and they get them to join the church. Most churches do that. some churches do a pretty good job of getting people to second base. They get them growing in their faith, and they get them maturing, and they get them developing spiritual habits like a quiet time, a small group, and tithing, and things like that. Very few churches get people to third base. How to specifically train people for their ministry to discover their spiritual shape, help them find the place, their niche in life, and even fewer get people back out into the world doing their life mission where they're sharing Christ where they work. We have a series of classes that you can get if you'd like to get them. And again, you take our material and tear it up, rewrite it, put your own illustrations in it, put your own name on it, it's fine, and you can use it as long as you just use it in your own local church. You can read the rest of these. I think they're all pretty much explanatory and they're covered in the book, because I want to get on right now to the next section, and that is targeting your community for evangelism. And Pastor Tom is going to come and kick us off on this, and then I'll come back and finish it up.
Thanks, Rick. Well, as Rick said, it's good to be with you today. We feel really at home in this church. It looks somewhat like our church with the windows on the side and the same kind of ceiling that we have in some way. So it's great to be with you. There's a scripture at the top of page 19 that I'd like you to read along with me. Matthew chapter 4, 19. Let's read it together. Jesus called out, "Come along with me, and I will show you how to fish for the souls of men." I don't believe that Jesus used the analogy of fishing for the souls of men by accident. He knew that down through the ages it would be a picture that would help us to understand how you and I can reach people for Jesus Christ. He chose this analogy because he knew the parallels that it would have for effective evangelism for us. And so in this session we're going to talk about Jesus' strategy of fishing for men. His strategy for effective evangelism. It grows out of Matthew 10 and Luke 10 as he taught his disciples and apostles to go out. Principle number one, jot this in with me, is you got to know who you are fishing for. Know what you're fishing for. You have to begin by clearly identifying who you're trying to reach. Now, let me ask you this. In most churches, in a typical church, if you ask them, who are you trying to reach, what would they say? Everybody. Everybody. And yet, the truth of the matter is, no church can appeal to everybody at the same time. We all appeal to certain portions of the population. You're kidding yourself if you think you can appeal to everybody. It's like a radio station saying, let's have a classical number to start off the day, and then let's do a jazz number, and then let's add in a heavy metal number next, and then let's do a another classical number, and let's do a children's number. How many people would listen to that radio station? Nobody. Nobody. And yet, many times in church, we just miss the point of this strategy. The kind of fish that you want to catch will determine your strategy. So you have to begin by saying, what kind of fish are we fishing for? It helps you and I to know who are we fishing for. Would it be a different strategy if you're fishing for teenagers than if you're fishing for senior adults, for instance? Would you think there'd be a different strategy? Well, of course there would. It helps us to know that in the New Testament, this is a strong part of the teaching of the New Testament. Targeting for evangelism was a strategy that was God's use throughout God's Word. Look in Matthew chapter 15, 24. Jesus targeted. He said, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel." He knew his target. He knew that he was supposed to speak to the Jews when he was here. And then that was to reach out from there. Paul said in Galatians, "I was entrusted to the task of preaching the gospel to the Gentiles." And when Jesus sent out his disciples, he sent them out with a target. He said, do not go amongst the Gentiles or in any town of the Samaritans. He told them who to go out and to reach. This isn't to be exclusive. This is to be effective. The truth of the matter is, the Gospels are targeted. Have you ever wondered why we have four Gospels? If you read the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, much of them are the same. Why do we need four of them? Because they're targeted. You know that Matthew was written to the Jews and Mark was written to the Romans. That there was a target for those Gospels. So even the four Gospels that we have are targeted in order to reach certain kinds of people. Problem is that many churches, when it comes to targeting, are a lot like Charlie Brown in that cartoon. He had a bow and arrow, and he was shooting bow and arrow into a fence. He'd shoot it into the fence, and when it hit, he'd walk up and he'd draw a circle around where he'd hit. And he'd say, "That way I know I'm hitting my target." And that's what we do a lot of times. Once we hit somebody, we say, "Oh, that's it. That's my target." But it's good to know in advance, who are we trying to reach? Now, how do you define your target? A few ideas for you here. First of all, define your target geographically. You know that people are only going to come mostly from a certain distance. So you ask how many people live in this area. And there's just some simple ideas there. Just draw a map around your area representing some circles. Find out the number of people who are living within that area. Figure about 50% of that population in America is unchurched. It'd be probably higher than that in Australia, wouldn't it? And so because you know that, you know that that number, you see that little pond as we drove in today? You got to know what your fishing pond is as a church. That number is your fishing pond. That's who you're trying to reach as a church. Number two, define your target demographically. Demographically. Once you find out how many people live in your area, then you have to ask, what kind of people live in this area? And there's some ideas here for some ways that you and I can do that. You can ask how many people in different age groups, how many are single, how many are married, what do they earn, educational, occupational. There's some sources there for where to get this information. But the point is, as a pastor, you need to be the number one expert on your community. Why? Because people need the Lord. Pastors should know more about their community than anybody else. Number three, define your target culturally. You ask yourself, what are the values, interests, and fears? This is a term called psychographics. What's the mindset? What's the lifestyle of the people that you're trying to reach? One reason that some churches don't grow, real honestly, is people blindness. They aren't sensitive to the fact that there are cultural differences amongst people. Let me ask you this. Are all white people alike? No. Are all black people alike? No. Are all Asian people alike? No. And because people are different, we need to find out who are those people that we're trying to reach. Not just based on color of skin, but also based on what's happened in their lives, their educational background, everything about them. You define your target demographically. And then culturally. One of the best sources for a cultural understanding of people is a personal survey that we're going to look at in just a few minutes together. We've got to begin to see our community as it really is. And then you define your target spiritually. You ask yourself, what do they already know about the gospel? Because their values about the gospel and their religious background are really going to determine where you can start with them. For instance, in the Western United States, we know that the number one background in our area of people is Catholic. They're former Catholics. And because of that, we know they have a certain knowledge about the gospel of Christ. They have certain things that they know. They know who God is. They have a certain value on God's Word. And because of that, we can use that as we teach and we preach with them. Often, when we say that you've got to define your target, people will say, well, my target is unchurched people. I want to reach unchurched people, people who are not believers. Well, just because it's an unchurched person doesn't mean that all unchurched people are the same. Isn't that true? Unchurched people are very, very different. And so you have to determine who are we trying to reach. The fact is, all unchurched people are not alike. And because of that, there's no single way to build a service or a church that reaches people who haven't been churched before. Now, once you've defined your target, then you have to personalize your target. Decide, how are we going to picture this person? In fact, if you look on page 21, here's our picture. This is our Saddleback Sam. This is our target. This is our Mr. Orange County. Now, I don't know what you want to call it. You might want to call it Brisbane Bob or, you know, Sydney Sam or whatever. But whatever your name is, that'll be the person that you're trying to reach. We've asked ourselves, how can we reach this person? Let me ask you. Here's our guy. He's well educated. He likes his job. He likes where he lives. His health and fitness are our priorities. He's skeptical of organized religion, so we tell him, come to Saddleback. We're disorganized religion. He's self-satisfied. He's smug. Let me ask you, if this was the guy you were trying to reach, how would you reach him? How would you reach him? Let me give you a couple different ideas, and we can vote on them. Here's an idea. How about if when he's at the grocery store, we go up and we put a little track under his windshield. He comes out, he opens it up, and it says, come to church or go to hell. How many of you think that'll work? Anybody think that'll work? One guy over there. How about this? How about if we... He's driving in and out of the city, hour maybe each way. He comes home. His home is his castle. He wants to hide out. He gets home and he's sitting down watching a football, soccer game. He's got his TV dinner in front of him. How about if we send a stranger to knock on his door and interrupt his dinner? How many of you think that's going to work? No, that's not going to work. You see, this is a guy that has to be reached for the gospel through a different means. And you have to know the person that you're trying to reach. The point is, when you specifically define your target, it's easier to hit that target. Now, some people say, that takes too much time. I mean, we don't have time to work with all this target definition. That's like a photographer going out and saying, I'm going to just take some pictures and click, click, click. I don't have time to focus, but click, 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 and I hope they come out okay. That's like two deer hunters going up on top of a mountain and just taking their guns and going, bam, 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 down into the valley and saying, sure hope we hit something down there. You see, the time that it takes to think about who you're trying to reach is never wasted. It's never wasted. So, if you turn the page with me, after you've defined your target, you need number two to learn to think like a fish. Learn to think like a fish. It helps to understand the if you're a fisherman, the habits and the preferences, the feeding patterns of a fish. Now, all fish aren't alike. Some of them like the fast water where the oxygen is. Some of them like the slow and still water. They're all different. You have to figure out what kind of fish are we trying to reach? What kind of person are we trying to reach? If you and I are going to reach unbelievers for Jesus Christ, we have to learn to think like they think. Jesus did this. Look at all these verses where the Bible says Jesus knew what they were thinking. He knew what they were thinking. And the Holy Spirit in our lives can help us to understand what the unchurched are thinking. And the Bible says in Matthew chapter 10, verse 16, I'm sending you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore, be as wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. Problem is, for most of us in church, we get the second half of that, don't we? We're as harmless as doves, but we don't get the wise as serpents side down. We don't use the wisdom. We don't, as Colossians 4 or 5 says, be wise in the way that you act toward those who are unbelievers. The problem with learning to think like an unbeliever, learning to think like a fish, jot this in with me, is the longer that I'm a believer, the less I think like an unbeliever. Would you agree with that? The longer I know Christ, the less I think like an unbeliever. Problem for me is I'm a pastor. I'm actually two generations removed from an actual pagan out there, unbeliever. I have a very difficult time thinking like an unbeliever. It's a very difficult job. And so you and I have to intentionally discover what unbelievers think and understand that when people are resistant to the gospel, it's often just that I haven't taken the time to think like they think. It's often just poor communication on my part. And so, we've got to learn to stop saying people are closed to the gospel and start saying, how can I get on their wavelength? Because Jesus Christ can meet their needs. Now, how do you discover the mindset of unbelievers? This is one of the most important parts of targeting. How do you discover what unbelievers think? Read a book? Watch a television show? This may seem obvious, but this is incredibly important. How do you discover the mindset of unbelievers? You talk to them. And they'll talk back to you. It's an incredible thing. And as they talk to you and you talk to them, you discover what they think. And by actually talking to them, not reading a book about what somebody else says they think, talking to the people in your area who don't know Christ, you start to get a feel for who they are and what they think. If you don't ask the right questions, you won't get the right answers, though. And if you don't get the right answers, you won't develop the right strategy. If you don't develop the right strategy, you won't get the right result. And so it all starts with asking the right questions of those that you talk to. Now, on the next page, we talked earlier about using a personal opinion poll. Here's how Saddleback Church started. It started with a personal opinion poll. Rick went out. He asked hundreds and hundreds of unbelievers these five questions that you see listed here. In fact, these same five questions, this same survey has been used by literally thousands of churches to start churches. There was one denomination in the United States that a few years ago started 103 churches on the same day, just using these questions and based on that, beginning the church. Question number one, you go and you knock on somebody's door, you see them in a restaurant, wherever, and you say, number one, are you active in a local church? And if the answer to that is yes, then you say, thank you very much, it's great to meet you, God bless you, keep on serving the Lord, but I'm not interested in your opinion. Because you're interested in the opinion of unbelievers at this point. And if the person says, no, I'm not active at all, I'm not sure I ever would be, then you say, great, you're just the person I want to talk to. Your opinion is very valuable to me. Number two, what do you feel is the greatest need in this area? And they'll give you all kinds of answers, a lot of them that aren't spiritual answers, but it'll help them to begin to talk about needs. Question number three is, why do you think most people don't attend church? You might circle the words most people in that. You see, back in the 1950s, Rick got the idea for this question from a guy named Robert Schuller, who started a church back in the 1950s in Southern California. But in the 1950s, he phrased it this way, "Why don't you attend church?" Now, 1990s America, if you asked an American, "Why don't you attend church?" they'd say back to you, "None of your business." Is that true in Australia too? Yeah, so you have to ask it in a non-threatening way. Why do you think most people don't attend church? 9 times out of 10 people are going to give you why they don't go to church anyway. And so you just ask it in a non-threatening way. If you were looking for a church, what kind of things would you look for? What advice would you give me? How can I help you? Now, realize they're going to give you some things that you can't do anything about, but they'll give you some incredible information. In fact, the 4 greatest complaints in our area are listed for you there. You might see what they are in your area. One was sermons are boring and irrelevant. Who said amen over there? Who was that? Oh, that was Rick's dad. That was the number 2. Members are unfriendly to visitors. Number 3, too much emphasis on money. They just want to get your money. Number 4, poor child care. We had a lot of baby boomers in our area, people with children. In fact, they had children later in life. And have you discovered that when people have children later in life, they're a little more picky about their kids and how they're treated? And so, if you look at these, again, there's nothing theological there. There's nothing about God or Jesus there, is there? In fact, we discovered that unchurched people weren't atheists. They're just turned off and too busy. They're turned off to the gospel, maybe even not the gospel, they're turned off to church. And they're too busy. They just don't have time. And if somebody could just show them that there was a church that could meet their needs, they'd be interested. Now look at the next page. This is the letter that began Saddleback Church. The letter was sent out to our community. It said, "At last, a new church for those who have given up on traditional church services. Let's face it, many people aren't active in church these days. Why? Too often. And then watch how we just turned around their complaints and said, here's how those needs can be met. Too often the sermons are boring and they don't relate to daily living. Many churches seem more interested in your wallet than in you. Members are unfriendly to visitors. You wonder about the quality of the nursery care for your little ones." It just reflected back what they were saying because we were willing to meet those needs in their lives. Just find a way to neutralize their objections. Then, once you've begun to think a little bit like a lost person, Rick's going to come up and talk to us about point number 3.
Mentioned there. I mentioned earlier that I mentioned earlier that in the last 30 months, we have baptized over 3,000 new believers. How does that happen? How are you able to reach people like that? Well, the answer is, as Tom has just been saying, you have to learn to fish like Jesus. You know what you're fishing for. Then you learn to think like a fish, learn to think like an unbeliever. And then step number 3 is go where the fish are biting. Go where the fish are biting. It is a waste of time to fish where no fish are biting. Would you agree with that? Yeah. And yet we do this all the time. Wise fishermen move on. They know that when a spot, no fish are biting there, you just go down this river a little bit or try another part of the stream or try another part of the lake. You need to focus on the most receptive people in your area. Now this principle of receptivity is taught all through the New Testament. It's the parable of the sower. The sower goes out and he sows seed on rocky ground. God says, don't do that. And he sows it on shallow ground. He says, don't do that. He says, sow your seed where there is good ground. And too often as churches, we just scattershot the gospel without focusing the seed where it's going to be the most receptive. Now, have you learned that people tend to be open to the gospel at some times in their lives and at other times they tend to be closed? Isn't that true? Sure. And that season of receptivity varies very widely. Now, Jesus knew this. And that's why he said, you should go to receptive people in your community. Notice what he said in Matthew 10, when he sent the disciples out, he said, if a home or town refuses to welcome you or listen to you, read this with me, leave that place and shake the dust off your feet. Now, this is a very significant statement. He's saying, don't hang around unresponsive people. Don't waste your time spreading the gospel when people aren't ready to hear it. Listen, there are far more Australians ready at this moment to receive the gospel than we are ready to share it. What we have to do is find them and then go to them. He says, don't pick fruit when it's green. And if the fruit is ripe, you don't have to yank it. You don't have to force anybody. You don't have to pressure anybody. When people are ready to receive the gospel, it's God's job to get them ready. It's our job to reap the harvest. And so God says, go where the fish are biting. Now, have you ever heard this phrase before? Pastor, I think before we go out and reach any new people, we ought to go back and reclaim all the inactive people in our church. Ever heard that one? Guaranteed strategy for church decline. It takes 10 times more energy to reactivate an inactive member than it does to go reach a new person. Some of those people need to go to somewhere else. They need to go to somebody else's church. The fact is, God has called you to feed sheep, not corral goats. Now, some of you, that's all you needed to hear. Go home, okay? God has spoken to you. You know now, you don't have to waste your time on that. Write this down. Growing churches focus on reaching receptive people, while non-growing churches focus on re-enlisting inactive people. So then the question becomes, who are the most receptive people? How do I find the receptive people in Brisbane or Ipswich or anywhere else? How do I know who the receptive people are? It's very easy. There are two things that make people receptive to the gospel. Transition and tension. When people are in transition or under tension, they're more open to the gospel than at any other time. So you look for people who are either experiencing change or experiencing problems. That tends to make them open to the gospel. When people are in transition, they have a new job, a new home, a new baby, a graduation. They've just gotten married. They've just moved to town. They're new residents. They're more open to the gospel than at other times when things are pretty stable in their lives. Likewise, people are more open to the gospel when they're under tension, when there is financial tension, emotional tension, marriage stress, physical problems, relational problems. Those are the things that make people open to the gospel, because then they start saying, there must be a God. Could God help me? And you look for those kind of people. God says, if they're not receptive, don't worry about them. I'll make them receptive later on, then you can reach them. But right now, work on those where the fruit is ripe. Get it? Good. Number four, catch fish on their own terms. Now, what that means is you let your target determine your approach. And this is the heart of Saddleback strategy. We start where people are, not where we want them to be. You must catch fish, if you're going to be fishers of men, on their terms. You know, growing up, I have to tell you this about my dad, since he's here today. My dad is the greatest fisherman I've ever met in my whole life. I don't know why, but whenever we would go fishing, if there was one fish in a lake, he would catch it. I never could figure this out. We'd take a whole group, we'd all go fishing, we'd come back empty-handed, he'd have this stringer full of fish. And I used to just wonder, does God like him better? You know, is that just what it is? God just likes him, and so he gets all the fish. Then I realized finally that my dad understands fish. He thinks like a fish. Okay? And what I'm saying is, when my dad would go out to go fishing, he could read a lake, and he'd look around, and he goes, okay, now this is where the fish are, this is where they are, this is where... He knew where they were, he knew where they weren't. He knew what time of day they would be eating. He knew when they wouldn't be eating. He knew just what kind of bait they liked best. He knew just how far to drop the hook into the water. He knew what they would like, when they would like it, where they would like it. He would provide the food for them on their terms, in their place, in their habitat. My dad would wade through mud up to here to get to the right fishing spot, or go through brush or to get to the fishing spot. Whatever it would take to get to the fish, he would get there. Now, I, on the other hand, always tend to fish the way it's convenient for me. And rather than choosing where are the fish, I would choose the place where there was shade. Where I could sit up my little lawn chair, sit down, open my bag of potato chips and my Coke, sit back, throw out the hook and say, you know, if you want it, take it or leave it. You know? Kind of a lackadaisical approach to fishing. And guess what? They left it. Because I was fishing on my terms rather than on their terms. Now, we do this all the time in churches. We say, hey, we want to win you to Christ, but you must come to our place on our day at our time, 10:30, and wear our kind of clothes and sing our kind of songs and listen to our kind of service and speak our kind of language, and then we'll share the good news. Take it or leave it. And they are leaving it by the millions in my country and in yours. We have to learn to take fish on their own. You know that the average fisherman never ventures more than about a half a mile from a paved road because we want to fish where it's convenient. Now look at what Jesus said in Luke chapter 10. He says, when you enter a town, he's giving advice to these guys going on an evangelism expedition. When you enter a town and are welcomed, eat what is set before you. Now, would you circle that? Because Jesus is giving here more than dietary advice. He's giving a principle. He's saying, I want you, when you go out to reach people, reach the unchurched, when you're going to go reach seekers, I want you to adapt to the local customs and culture, as long as it doesn't violate the Bible. You know, I have to tell you, years ago, I was a summer missionary to Japan. And I had never eaten Japanese food. And honestly, I didn't like a lot of what I ate. Now, since then, I've learned to like it. In fact, it's one of my favorite kind of foods. But when I lived in Japan, I always ate what was set before me. Not because I loved the food, but because I loved the Japanese. And I wanted to win them to Christ. And so it didn't matter whether I liked it or not. I wasn't there to go after my likes and preferences. I was there to go after their likes and preferences in order to win them to Christ. Now, most of the time, we want to plan a service according to our likes and preferences, not according to the likes and preferences of the unchurched. And that's why none of the fish. Have you ever noticed that when you go fishing, I've noticed this, fish, when I'm in a boat, don't automatically jump into my boat and say, eat me. And when I'm on the land, they don't immediately flop up onto the shore and say, please, catch me, catch me. No. The only way I'm going to be able to reach fish is I've got to get in their culture. Now, I have discovered that my culture, human being, is very different from their culture, a fish. My culture is air. Their culture is water. And if I'm going to catch fish, I have to get the bait, the hook, the message into their culture in front of their nose. Or there's not going to be no caught. And that's true in evangelism. As long as we play it safe and say, we'll catch you if you come into our culture, these safe four walls of the church, we're not going to catch many fish. He says, adapt your situation, go where the fish are biting, and catch fish on their terms. Now, those of you who are fishermen, have you ever had to change bait in the middle of the day? In other words, what the fish were biting on in the morning, they weren't then biting on later in the evening. Yes, this happens often for anybody who fishes often. The problem with our churches is that we are still using bait and hooks and methods from the 1950s, and they aren't working in the 1990s. And the fish aren't biting on them anymore. And so thousands stay away from our churches because the bait is not interesting anymore. The message is interesting, but we haven't learned how to share it in a way and get it in their culture the way they want to. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 9, Paul's evangelism strategy. He says, to the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. In the same way, with the Gentiles, I become like a Gentile in order to win the Gentiles. I have become all things to all men that I may save some of them by any means possible. Now, he's saying here, you can't expect unbelievers to act like believers until they are. And today he'd say, you know, when I'm in California, I become like a Californian to reach Californians. And when I'm in Japan or Korea, I become like a Korean to reach the Koreans. And when I'm on the Gold Coast, I become like somebody on the Gold Coast in order to reach the people of the Gold Coast. Or the Sunshine Coast. He says you have to start where people are, not where you want them to be. I once studied Jesus, and I said, what was Jesus' standard approach to evangelism? How did Jesus reach people? What was his standard? Did he use the four spiritual laws? Did he use the Romans road? What was his method? And I discovered Jesus' standard method was,
he didn't have one. His only method was this: start where people are. So when he's with the woman at the well, he talks about water. And when he's with fishermen, he talks about fish. And when he's with farmers, he talks about sowing seed. And today, if he were with businessmen, he'd talk with them about business. And when he's with computer people, he'd talk about computers. He'd just start where people are. Now, this is very important. To be effective in evangelism, you have to be flexible. On the next page, 27, here's Saddleback's evangelism strategy. Number one, the unchurched needs determine our programs. Jesus said, it's not the healthy you need a doctor, but the sick. I didn't come to call the righteous, but the sinners. So, we let the unchurched needs determine our programs. If there's a lot of people having divorces in our community, then we have divorce recovery programs. If people are having a problem with difficulty with drug and alcohol addiction, then we have drug and alcohol addiction programs, which we do. If we have people who say, you know, I'd like to learn to lose weight, then we will set up a weight loss program. Now, obviously, I'm not a part of that one. But the point is, we have over 100 ministries at our church, all of them set up basically according to the needs of people in the community. What does the community need? And we start with their needs, not our own. We let them do it. We believe anybody can be won to Christ if you know the key to his heart. And the key to his heart are his felt needs. Where is he hurting? Before you can share the good news, you've got to capture their attention. Now, what are there any universal needs? They say, well, what are the felt needs of my community? The answer is, I don't know. I don't know what are the needs of your community. That's why you need to go out and take that survey that Tom just talked about, where you go door to door like I did and knocked over on over 500 doors and simply said, what's your need? How can I help you? What can I do for you? That's what the church exists for. Not, come help us. I saw a church that had a sign, come help us grow. You don't say that to the community. You come help. Give us your time, your money, your effort, your energy. Help us do our thing. Who cares? What we want to say to the church, to the community is, what can we do for you? How can we help you? Study how many times Jesus said to somebody, what do you want me to do for you? Because he did. He said it often. Now, are there any needs that are universal, no matter what culture? Yes, there are. And they are, the felt needs of the unchurched American, Australian, Japanese, or anything else, are primarily emotional and relational. Emotional and relational needs. I have discovered that around the world, everybody has a need for acceptance, for love, for purpose, for forgiveness, for confidence. They need freedom from bitterness, from guilt, from worry, from fear, from depression, from discouragement. These are universal needs. Church in our area that went out and they took this survey and they went door to door, and there was a lot of young couples in their community. They said, what is the greatest need in this area? And it came back, there's a lot of young couples with little children that hadn't learned to use the toilet yet. So they said, the greatest need is potty training. How to train our children not to wet their pants. And so they thought, now how could a church help that? And so they set up a potty training seminar. And they invited a Christian doctor in, talked about how to train your child to use the toilet rather than wet his pants. They had a Christian counselor talk about strong families. The pastor preached. They had over 500 unchurched people, couples, come to the potty training seminar. And they reached dozens of them for Christ in the months ahead. I was joking with them. I said, I bet your theme verse was Proverbs 22:6, which is, train up a child in the way he should go. There is no interest that cannot be used to reach people for Christ. It could be underwater basket weaving for Christ. The unchurched needs determine our programs. Number two, the unchurched hang-ups determine our strategy. For instance, if they have a hang-up about financial appeals in church, well, in our church we simply say, the service for seekers, if you are a visitor of our church, it is our policy to tell you, please do not give. The offering is only for those who are members and regular attenders of the church. And if you're a visitor here today, we ask you not to give. We want you to just get something. That surprises them. It also disarms one of their greatest complaints.
We say, we're not here to get your money, so don't even think about it. We want you to get something. If they have a problem with denominational labels. In my area, I'm a Southern Baptist. If I put Southern Baptist on my title to the unchurched person in California, you didn't want to know what they thought about it. Because I asked them. Now, so we just chose a neutral name, Community Church. You say, well, Rick, if you didn't put your denominational name in your title, were you criticized by your denomination? What do you think? Yeah, of course I was. But you know what? I'm more interested in impressing the non-believer than I am in impressing my former university and college professors. Okay? You have to decide who are you trying to impress. And Jesus said, I didn't come for those who are well. I come for the sick, for the unrighteous. The Bible says, notice this verse, Luke 16:18. The people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than the people of light. So we let the unchurched hang-ups determine our strategy. If they have a hang-up about being real formal, well, we dress real informal. This is the way all of our pastors dress. I'd rather have a guy come to church in shorts and a Foster's t-shirt, then not come. Okay? Then not come. I don't care what he looks like. Jesus didn't, obviously. And so, that's important. The unchurched culture determines our style. You know, we happen to be a beach community where I am, so we're very casual. You know, my idea of winter is I put on socks. So obviously I don't think it's winter here in Australia. And the unchurched population determines our goals. We don't grow just to be bigger. That motive died a long time ago. We grow because as long as there's one person in our community who doesn't know Christ, we have to keep growing. The unchurched go to hell. That's our motive. People without Christ die without Christ. And so we grow not because we need to be bigger. Oh, listen, my favorite size was 300 people. Frankly, the bigger the church gets, the more headaches there are, the more stress there is, the more pressure there is, the less privacy I have. There are sacrifices it takes. But the fact is we grow because everybody needs Jesus. Everybody needs Jesus. And as long as one person in your city doesn't know Christ, you are commanded to keep growing. You can never say, well, we've got enough. The church that says, well, we've got enough, is saying to the world, you can go to hell. Let's just admit it. It's selfish. And it takes unselfish people to grow a church. Now, number five. If you want to fish like Jesus, you've got to use more than one hook. That means you have to offer people options and choices. We call this trot line fishing. The more hooks you use, the more fish you're going to catch. That's why Paul says, I become all things to all men that I may save some of them by all means possible. Now today we live in a world of choices. You know, it used to be there was one kind of Coke. There was Coke. Now we got Diet Coke. We got sugar-free Coke. We got caffeine-free Coke. We have Cherry Coke. We have Diet Sugar-free Caffeine-free Coke, which is tasteless. We have, you know, Clear Coke. You know, how many Cokes do we need? You know, in my community, we used to have 3 TV channels. I can go in now with cable and get 56 channels on my television. It's amazing. The more channels there are, the less there is really the worth watching. Isn't that amazing? And so we have this idea where Levi's Corporation has over 60,000 different choices, sizes, shapes, and colors. And we live in a world of choices. Then when we come to Bible study, the church has 2 choices. Take it or leave it. And then we wonder why they're not coming. We must offer multiple choices. Saturation evangelism is using every available means to reach every available person at every available time. Now, the reason why we only fish with one hook, usually we just have a service. We expect people to come get saved at a service, and that's it. Maybe a concert or this or that. The reason why is we ask the wrong question. The reason why we don't spend more money on evangelism is because we ask, how much will it cost? Instead, we should be asking the right question, which is, who will it reach? How much is it worth of a soul? Now, because this is so important, I want to give you 4 steps here in financing evangelism in your church. It's very important. Financing evangelism in your church. Number one, money spent on evangelism is never an expense. It is an investment. Now, what I mean by that
is that the people you reach from spending the money on outreach will more than repay what you spent. When Saddleback had 15 people and we were planning our first service, we went out and we went nearly $6,000 in debt planning the first service, renting a secondary school building, buying nursery equipment, doing a mass mail out. We took that letter and 15 of us, we hand addressed and hand stamped 15,000 letters and mailed them out 10 days before Easter to plan our first service. I mean, we were serious about starting. And we spent our own money. Where did you get money? We took our credit cards and we used our own credit cards to finance the church. It was a step of faith. Because we believed that the people we would reach would inevitably eventually pay us back. And sure enough, within 6 months, all of the people were paid back. If I spend $100 on an advertisement and it reaches one person and that one person comes to Christ, within a year, his tithe has more than paid it back. Of course. So it's an investment. Now, you know, usually when the budget gets tight, we cut our outreach and evangelism and advertising. That's the last thing you need to cut. It's the lifeblood of your church. It's the future. Number two, churches never really have money problems. They have idea problems. Money flows to God-given, Holy Spirit-inspired and anointed ideas. If you're continually short on cash, it's because you don't have a big enough vision. Now, look up here before you get this next point. Get this. People do not give. They're not motivated by need. They're motivated by vision. If needs motivated people to give, we would never have any needs. Every church needs more money. And yet every church never has enough. Why? Because people give to vision, not need. Why is it that the universities that have all the endowments next year will get even more money? Because they have the vision. That's why we've never put on our wall a thermometer that says, this is how much money we need, and this is how much money we've got, and this is how much money we're short. Do paying bills, does that motivate you? Bill paying never motivates anybody. So catch-up, shortfall giving never motivates anybody. Instead, what you need to say, this is what we're going to do, this is our vision, here's the people we're going to reach, here's what we're going to do. People give to exciting vision, not to need. Number three, on page 29, when you spend nickels and dimes, or you know, pennies on evangelism, you get nickel and dime results. In other words, you get what you pay for. By the way, do you remember the story in the New Testament where Jesus told Peter to go down to the seaside, catch a fish, and he said, there'll be a coin in the mouth of the fish, and that you can pay the taxes with that? Do you remember that story? There's a principle there. The coins are always in the mouth of the fish. And if you will focus on fishing, God will pay your bills. The church that focuses on evangelism rather than its budget doesn't have a problem with its budget. You focus on evangelism. You focus on fishing and God will pay your bills. Number four, Hudson Taylor says, God's work done God's way will not lack God's support. Finally, and this is the most important of all, you need to fish for the kind of fish that you can best reach. Go after those you are most likely to reach. Now this, again, as Tom talked about earlier, is a basic New Testament strategy. It's not some marketing gimmick, but it's what the Bible taught. You go after people you're most likely to reach. When Andrew went out to reach somebody, who did he reach? His brother, Peter. Matthew went out, he was a tax collector, he had a party for other tax collectors. When the woman at the well went out, she brought everybody back because she knew everybody. In the biblical sense of the word. So they all came to Jesus. Now, the point here is that your church is best suited to reach certain kind of people, and there's some people that your church is never going to reach. You just need to be honest about that. It's okay. That's why we need all kinds of churches to reach all kinds of people. There's no one way to grow a church. I can show you churches doing the exact opposite thing and they're both growing. Why? Different targets. How do you determine who your church can best reach? You ask yourself two questions. Number one,
What kind of people already attend our church? What kind of people already attend our church? Now this is important, because when a non-church person, a visitor, a non-Christian walks into your church, the first question he asks is not a theological question. When an unbeliever walks into this church, see, the first thing they ask isn't, I wonder if they believe in the inerrancy of Scripture. Do they practice transubstantiation or consubstantiation in the Lord's Supper? Yes. No. The first question a non-believer asks when they go to church is a sociological one. It's this. Is there anybody else here like me? When a visitor walks in, a teenager walks in, and the first thing he looks around, are there any other teenagers in here? When an elderly couple walk in, retirees walk in, any other retirees in here? Anybody else got gray hair, going bald? You know, a military person comes in, any serviceman, he walks in and says, are there any other service people, any other military people in here? Black person walks in, any other black people in here? A couple with a baby walks in, they say, does anybody else have a baby in here? And if we find somebody like ourselves, we're more likely to go back. If we don't, it's highly unlikely. We'll say, that church isn't for me. Now you need to understand this because it helps you determine who you can best reach. What is the likelihood of a church full of retirees in reaching teenagers? It's unlikely. What is the likelihood of a church full of military personnel in reaching peace activists? Pretty unlikely. What is a church full of people speaking Vietnamese in reaching people speaking Spanish? Not very likely. What is the likelihood of a church full of factory workers in reaching CEOs and professional people? Possible, but not very likely. Now here's the point. You must identify and understand the culture of your church as it is. See it as it really is. And you must realize, listen, you are most likely to reach more people like you've already got. Now, some of you pastors are going, oh, great. I paid good money to hear this guy, and he's going to leave me depressed. But it's true. And you cannot not be you. And you cannot deny this fact. You're just kidding yourself. The second question you ask yourself is, what kind of person am I? In other words, as a leader in the church, or as the pastor of a church, what is my cultural background? Now listen, God has uniquely prepared you to reach a certain kind of people. There are people in this world that I can reach better than you can, because they're like me. And there are people in this world that you can reach better than me or anybody else, because they're like you. Does that make sense? If God has called you to ministry, and I believe He has, because if you're a Christian, He's called you to ministry, that means He has some people in this world that you can reach better than anybody else. And you need to focus on those, and you'll be more effective, and you'll have more joy in your Christian life when you share. And just admit it, and don't worry about it. Now, here are the points. I can best reach people I relate to. I can best reach people that I relate to. And number two, you attract what you are, not what you want. Your greatest contribution will occur when you match your target. Now let me give you an example. I had one of the men we started a church with. He came from Atlanta. He had started a church and grown it to 200, so I knew he had great skills. And he came to Southern California, and we started a church, and 6 months later, nothing was happening. I mean, he couldn't even get the thing off the ground. I said, John, what do you think the problem is? He says, I don't fit. He said, this area of this city, Irvine, is middle-aged folks with teenagers, then they're wealthy. I said, who do you think you can best reach? He said, I think people like me. I said, you're right. He said, young couples just starting out in their first home or single adults. I said, oh, then you don't need to be in the city of Irvine. You need to be in the city of Huntington Beach. We killed the church where he was.
moved two cities over, started in Huntington Beach, and in a couple years, he was running over 200, about 250. I have a friend who's a black man. His name's Dave. He's in Long Beach. He came to me and said, "You know, Rick, I don't match my church." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "I have several advanced degrees, and I tend to talk with a very educated vocabulary, and most of the people in my church have only a high school or secondary education." I said, "Well, Dave, where are the educated, professional black people in Long Beach?" He said, "They're about 3 or 4 miles down the street." I said, "For heaven's sake, resign your church. Go down the street. Start a church there." He did. And a few years later, his church was running over 300 in attendance. Right guy, wrong place. Now, if you don't match your church, that's okay. It's no sin. Just move. And you will eventually find the place where you fit. You know, when I was in university, I was an interim pastor of a church of about 50 people. And the church, I'll be honest with you, I have no mechanical ability in my life. I cannot fix anything. I'm terrible at it. I am in awe of people who repair cars. I couldn't fix a carburetor if I had to. I'm just all thumbs. I just couldn't do it. I'm in awe. If you could do it, you're amazed me. And I was pastoring a church of truck drivers. I mean, they even would drive their rigs to church. And the parking lots were real long, you know. And those people loved me, and they were kind to this young preacher boy, and they were very gracious and put up with me. But I didn't fit there. And they knew it. And I knew it too. And the best thing in the world was to let me get them somebody who could pastor them. And me moved somewhere else. And the reason Saddleback has grown is because I fit. Now, when you have a church, the people in a community match the kind of people that are in the church, and they match the kind of people the pastor is, you have an equation for super exponential growth. If any of those are out of balance, growth is possible, but it is more difficult. Does that make sense? All right. What do you do when your church doesn't match your community? You have three alternatives, three options. Number one, build on your strength. Build on your strength. That means just keep doing what you're doing, but just try to do it better. There may be some people, more people out there like you, and you just keep, you know, if you are a McDonald's and you're not selling a lot of hamburgers, you don't try to become, you know, a taco shop. You just try to make better hamburgers. And so you build on your strength. You don't become a Colonel Sanders, KFC, or whatever. Number two, second option is to reinvent your congregation. Reinvent your congregation. That's where you intentionally change the makeup of your church to match a new target. And you say, we're going to completely change the worship service, completely change the style, completely change the programs, and we're going to throw out all the old and start with the new. Now look up here. I do not advise this! You will have inevitable conflict. There will be World War III in your church. People will leave the church. You will be vilified. You will be criticized. You will be called Satan incarnate. There will be blood spilled, and it will be yours. And don't even plan on doing this unless you intend to be a martyr. There will be enormous bloodshed and pain. I would say, don't even think about this if you're in a church larger than 100 people, unless God tells you to do it. Now, it has been done, but it takes enormous leadership skills, enormous amounts of love, and enormous amounts of patience to do that. However, if you were in a small church of, say, 50 people or less, this is a viable option for you. Why? Because in a small church, if you lose three families and you get three new families and you have 35 in your church anyway, you've just changed the church. One really great thing about a small congregation is you can revolutionize it fairly quickly if you are willing to let people be mad at you and if you are willing to let people leave the church for the greater good of the kingdom and the glory of God. So it can be done in a small church. But the larger you get, the more difficult that becomes. The third option, and the one I highly recommend, is to start new congregations to reach new groups. And you can either do this by adding an additional service, or you could do it by sponsoring a new church. You say, well, you know, we're not going to change the worship that we've got to the people. They like it the way we got it. But obviously, it's not reaching the people in the 30s and 40s, is it? It's reaching the retirees. And your kids aren't coming to church anymore. The ones that, and your grandkids who are in their 20s, they aren't coming either. So what if we start an alternative service that uses contemporary music and changes the order and maybe throws in some drama or has some testimonies or whatever? I highly recommend that. Or start additional churches. At some point, your church has to grow up. And how do you know when a church is mature? It has babies. Has your church had a baby yet? I know some churches that are 50 years old and have never had a baby. They're sterile. You need to start planning planned pregnancies, planned parenthood for churches. And you start saying, you know, by the year 2000, let's have a daughter church. And you pick an area where nobody's being reached, and you start going that. You say, well, what if we lose our members? You will lose, but you will gain. It's like giving blood. When you give away, God, you cannot outgive God. That's why I've started 26 daughter churches out of Saddleback, and we've continued to grow. Because always God blesses the church that gives itself away. Four steps to getting started. Learn all you can about your area. Divide your area into segments. And develop a clear, choose which group you're going to go after first, your target. And then develop a clear image of the type of church you want to be based on who you want to attract. Now, that's targeting the community.